This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. The idea of building a natural gas storage hub in the region continues to gain traction. West Virginia University is set to release a report this week that explores the geological possibilities of storing liquid natural gas products in underground reservoirs. Glynis Board attended a workshop that WVU hosted and brings us this report.
Natural gas industry players and researchers in the Ohio Valley gathered this week to hear about results of a new study exploring possibilities of building big underground gas storage systems in the region.
There is a true opportunity in front of us, and the time is of the essence, and we don't want this opportunity to slip through our fingers.
Director of the West Virginia University Energy Institute, Brian Anderson, spoke to about 100 workshop attendees. He says the WVU study found three types of geologic formations in the region where gas products like ethane, propane, and butane can be stored. The goal of such a system would be to create reliably priced, steady sources of feedstock for the petrochemical industry, a move researchers and lawmakers hope would lure industry to the region.
There have been a lot of innovations in smart manufacturing, efficient manufacturing, and lower environmental footprint manufacturing in the chemical sector that can now be rolled into a new rebirth of the petrochemical industry in our region.
Anderson and other industry experts are hopeful that tens of thousands of jobs could come with industry development. They say building out a gas storage hub is the first step to making that possible. Anderson says now that areas have been explored where gas could be stored underground, the next phase of research, which has already been funded, is exploring how to engineer such a hub. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania.
Officials say they're preparing for a second round of a program that aims to jumpstart tech jobs in coal country. Tech Hire in eastern Kentucky ended its first year amid some dispute over the program's success. Benny Becker reports that program organizers say they've learned some lessons that should help put more trainees to work in the tech sector.
This time last year, Melissa Anderson was unemployed and trying to figure out a way to keep her Pike County, Kentucky home from getting repossessed.
I have lived in that home for 20 years, and I built it. You know, for me to lose that home would have been devastating.
Anderson was one of over 800 people who applied for Tech Hire Eastern Kentucky, a program that pays participants to learn computer code and create phone apps. The program began with 54 participants, and 21 ended up in full-time, unsubsidized tech jobs. Anderson is one of 15 now employed by Interapt, the Louisville-based tech company that ran the program. She says she's now caught up on her mortgage payments.
I'm working in their marketing team and analytics, doing reports of how many people are actually going into their app, things of that nature. So I'm a numbers girl.
There's been controversy about whether the program created enough jobs, but plans are in the works for a second round of the federally funded program to start in the spring. Jeff Whitehead is director of the Eastern Kentucky Concentrated Employment Program, and he administered the nearly $3 million grant that funded the training. He says the second Tech Hire Eastern Kentucky will be run with multiple tech companies as partners.
It wasn't the results that we had hoped for, but if we hadn't had that humongous expectation, we'd be pretty happy. What we learned is that we need to create a broader spectrum of employers.
Ankur Gopal, CEO of Interapt, says his company will continue the work of training tech employees in rural communities, whether or not they take part in the second round of Tech Hire Eastern Kentucky.
We're looking at sites in Kentucky. We've been approached by the state of Wyoming, and we're in the process of announcing applications opening for those sites.
Kelly Cheney is a dean at Big Sandy Community and Technical College, which hosted Tech Hire Eastern Kentucky at its campus in Paintsville. Cheney says the space will continue to be used for tech job training.
We are partnering with healthcare, with advanced manufacturing, and some other sectors as well, but it's very much similar, having apprenticeships to do the work and be ready for a job.
Ankur Gopal says Eastern Kentuckians have shown that they're up to the task and should serve as a model for other parts of rural America.
We've proved there's capabilities, there's interest, there's a skill set that is untapped, and that's what we found.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Benny Becker in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:49. Some areas of fog this morning, becoming partly sunny today with highs in the 70s and lower 80s. Mostly cloudy skies tonight with lows in the 50s and 60s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow, a slight chance of rain with highs in the 70s and lower 80s. Support for the weather forecast is provided by Erie Insurance, putting service first since 1925. Local agents available at erieinsurance.com. Best-selling author Jeanette Wall spent most of her childhood west of the Mississippi River, but her father eventually brought her family back to McDowell County, where she lived for 4 years. She wrote about her time growing up in extreme poverty across the country in her memoir, The Glass Castle. The book has been on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 7 years, and the movie is now out in theaters. Inside Appalachia host Jessica Lilly spoke with Walls a few days before the movie hits theaters.
When did you decide to write this book and why?
You know, I tried a number of times when I was younger. In my 20s, I'd write a couple hundred pages and throw it away, and then a couple hundred pages when I was in my 30s. And I tried to fictionalize it one time. I didn't know if I was supposed to make it stranger or less strange. Like, what was I supposed to change? And then one day, I used to write about celebrities for a living, and I was in a taxi in New York City, and I saw a homeless woman rooting through the garbage, and I got a good look at her, and I realized it was my mother. And I got together with her a couple of days later, and I said, "Ma, what the heck am I supposed to tell people when they ask me about you?" And she said, "Tell them the truth." And that was sort of the kick in the behind I needed to confront this past of mine that I had for so long tried to escape and tried to pretend didn't exist. I was completely convinced that if people knew the truth about me, that I'd get fired. I did not think that my book would resonate, that it would sell well. That is not why I told my story. I told it because I couldn't not tell it any longer. I was just tired of being ashamed of who and what I was. I've come to believe that very often these things about ourselves that we dislike so much are the best thing we have going for us. And for me, it certainly was. This past that I've tried to cut myself off from, it was the better part of me. And that's why I've become such a big fan of storytelling. I think that if you can go back and revisit the sometimes painful memories, but also sometimes beautiful. The thing is, if you cut yourself off from the pain, you cut yourself off from the beauty as well.
I want to talk a little bit about McDowell County in southern West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like the writing and how you described Phoenix and places out west before you moved to West Virginia had more of a positive vibe to it. And when you get to McDowell County, there's a certain mm-hmm. darkness to mm-hmm. the language.
Yeah.
But in both places, you grew up in poverty.
Yeah.
Why was it different in McDowell?
I think it's, first of all, I think it's easier to be poor in a warm place, you know, especially if your parents don't provide heat in your housing. So, I mean, it was cold. It was cold in West Virginia. I mean, when we lived in McDowell County, coal was cheap at the time. We could have bought a ton for $35 to $50, and they just didn't buy it. It was cold, and I was hungry all the time. I mean, the school in Phoenix, it provided free lunches in a way that wasn't embarrassing. They made a big deal at the school I went to. If the lunch tickets were a different color if you got a free lunch, and Mom wouldn't let us do it. So I was cold, and I was hungry. It was not McDowell County's fault. It was not West Virginia's fault. But our circumstances got very, very grim there. And I think that one of the things that also happened is that my father was born in McDowell County, in Welch. And I think that returning home for him was a bit of a defeat. And he sank very deep into alcoholism because he went back with his mother and father, who were also alcoholics, and his brother. And he just got sucked back into this really destructive lifestyle. And we stopped moving around. It was always whenever times got tough, we just would stay there in one location for a short time, and then we'd move again and start afresh. Dad called it doing the skedaddle. And we just stopped moving. It was like my father had had confronted his demon, and the demons kind of won. This book is in no way meant to in any way disparage West Virginia or McDowell County or Welch, which is filled with lovely, kind, generous people. But our circumstances were very, very difficult. I think that one of the reasons that this book has resonated and has been on the bestseller list for some ridiculous amount of time, like 7 years, is because poverty and hardships and addiction, it exists everywhere. My story is not unique. Some people say, well, you know, it's extreme. And you'd be surprised by some of the stories that I hear, and sometimes in very affluent areas. You know, people go to great lengths to hide their poverty, and I did.
And you described your dad in the book as an alcoholic. And,
yeah.
But
yeah.
At the same time, you also paint him in a hero's light, as very innovative and smart.
My father was a magnificent man. I adore him, and to this day I miss him. He died in 1994. He was both the best and the worst of fatherhood. You know, but anybody who's dealt with an addict knows how they break your heart. He couldn't fight his demons, but he gave us the tools to do that as children. And, you know, he just always told us that we deserved something better, that we were strong, that we were resilient. All of this traveling around, all of this chaos, he always said that was temporary, that one of these days he was going to build us a great big mansion, and he called it the Glass Castle. And when times would get tough, he'd pull out the blueprints for the Glass Castle. It was about hope and belief in yourself and belief in the future, and I believe that if a child gets that, along with a love of education and a sense of self-esteem, that you can make it through just about anything, and that's why I'm not angry with him or anybody. I mean, I certainly bear no ill will towards my family or anyone I grew up with in West Virginia. You know, there's some tough stories there, and there still are. They're good people just trying to make it out. And one of the reasons I love having written this book is that so many people come up to me and they say, the details of our lives are very different, but you and I could be sisters. You know, and sometimes they were raised in fancy areas in Boston, but their father's a pill addict or something. And that's why we tell our stories. I'm not looking for sympathy, not looking to tell horror stories, but to make emotional connections with people who we might think there is no connection with.
And perhaps provide a window into this world and different realities. I mean, I know you said that you mentioned that people can relate to it, but it's also realities that not a whole lot of folks talk about. But
exactly.
showing that you can have those realities and you can still succeed and wearing it and being proud of it.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point to make. It's like, I think that some people look at, you know, poor folk and just think, oh, and put, you know, Why do they live that like that? White trash, black trash, whatever, you know, why don't they take care of themselves? And one of the reasons that I love this movie so much is it goes beyond the stereotypes and shows that people who, from a distance, you might be able to just be able to put a label on them and say, we know their type. But behind what we see, there's always a story. And things are much more complicated than you think. And they might look like people in desperate poverty, but there are hopes and dreams and love there as well. And that's something I hope people don't forget.
That was Jeanette Walls, author of the best-selling memoir and now motion picture called The Glass Castle, speaking with Inside Appalachia host Jessica Lilly. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Marshall University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Dave Mistich. I'm Teresa Wills.